Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, testing, testing. Okay, this is a tape of Mr. Drury Brown, December 16th. The first tape was messed up, and I'm trying to record from memory what he said. I condensed the questions because he was in a hurry. He's the director of the multi-service center. Okay, first question was about what do you know is the origin of Vinegar Hill, how it got its name, and how long it's been in existence. He said that he wasn't quite sure what the origin of Vinegar Hill was, but there was a long article in the paper about it, but he didn't know. And as long as he remembered, Vinegar Hill had been in existence. Okay, next question. I asked him, did he live there and where, and for how long did he live on the hill? He didn't live on the hill. He lived on Washington Avenue. He said that Vinegar Hill was the only place that blacks in Charlottesville had to go to and congregate. Because if you were outside of, you know, that whole area, police would stop you and ask you, you know, what were you doing here? And you'd better be on business, and you better not go outside that area if you could. He said it was the area where blacks had all their recreation and whatnot. The pool halls, the Saturday night dances. He said Saturday and Sunday night, that's where blacks hung out. Have a good time. That's the only place they could go. He said they had elks and masons. He said they also had social clubs. And he's in a social club that started back in the 40s. And what they mostly do now is like sponsored trips, bus trips. He went to Atlantic City last year. I've been to California, Los Angeles, all over the country, all kinds of places. And, you know, people pay dues and whatnot in these clubs. And he said that the Masons and the Elks, of course, they have their initiation and whatnot, and it's hard to get into, and not everybody's in them. Okay. He said... Okay, and that was community organization. He named all the churches, Zion, Union, Ebenezer, two other churches that are now, you know, in the same place they always went, that people always attended them. But some churches were torn down by urban renewal. The church over on Preston Avenue was torn down. Okay, of course, the schools were segregated. Everything was segregated in the town. The buses were segregated. He said if they said sit in the back of the bus, you went and you sat in the back of the bus, and you better not sit nowhere else. He said it was really hard on people in Charlottesville. Black youth didn't stay here long. They, you know, migrate northward or whatever for better opportunity, and they're still doing it. And he said a lot of blacks did go to college, but they came out just being teachers, and nobody really, you know, went into professional jobs, and nobody would come back here to Charlottesville and, you know, try and get a job because the job market was so bad, and it's so bad here in general for black people. Everybody goes to D.C. or California, New York, or Boston or somewhere. Okay, and I asked him about employment. What kind of jobs did people have on the hill? And he said he didn't think they had, technically they didn't have any kind of employment. Because either you were somebody's maid or domestic worker, something like that, and you didn't get paid nothing. And the jobs over here in the university weren't nothing. They still aren't anything. So he really didn't think that black people had much of any type of jobs. And those who did have any kind of business going, it was very, very hard, very rough on them, and they went through all kinds of stuff. Okay, he said the movie houses were segregated. Let me see now. They had I guess when the movie theater got full, white folks in the bottom, they'd take you out of the top balcony and put the white folks up there so they'd have a seat. He said about the hill, he said one thing they'd do, you know, when he was young, he'd tell the boys, you know, his friends, meet you on the hill about 1 o'clock, and they'd meet up on the hill about 1 o'clock and go to the movies, and come out of the movies and just hang around on the hill until it was time to go home. And that's also what it was for. He said the hill had, none of this is in order, pool halls and recreation centers. Over in Washington Park, he said there was one big building where everything was held, all the dances, all the recreation, all kinds of things. He said there were some black businesses on the hill. He couldn't quite remember how many there were. There weren't that many, barbershop and whatnot. But he said that for food and clothing and whatnot, people had to go into town, because the hill really didn't afford that. They had to go into town to buy the basic things, you know, they needed for their houses and whatnot. Let me see. Okay, Mr. Brown was very active politically in Charlottesville. First, he talked about the urban renewal, and he was against it because he felt that plenty could have been done to rehabilitate the housing instead of absolutely tear it down and move people out into West Haven and whatnot. And he was against moving people into West Haven. And he said that some of his property was taken away, and he took it to court and whatnot, but he never could get, you know, the proper money for the property that they, you know, took away. And he said it was like people got notices to move out. They're going to tear down your house, you know. And that's what they had to do. They just had to move out, and they really didn't have any choice in the matter. And the most that people did was people who owned big businesses up on the hill, they got their own kind of private counseling, private lawyers. And that really didn't do any good. What was needed was an effort among, you know, the whole community to try and stop this thing. There were referendums passed and whatnot was debated back and forth among, you know, blacks at that time, that at that time were in the city council and whatnot, but nothing could really be done because there really wasn't that much unity to try and stop it. He said he's also still against the way West Haven is run today, the fact that it's run by somebody who lives over in Esmont, and when they leave Friday, the heat goes off, or it's set at a certain temperature when they leave, and that's it. And it's not properly taken care of. And he was also against that high-rise senior citizens building that they moved a lot of people to. They said a lot of people, you know, just died during the move and whatnot. And let me see. Okay, he went back. He was very active in the civil rights movement of the 60s. He said that's when Charlottesville blacks were really united and was a really sense of community unity. He was evidently the leader at the NAACP chapter that was here in Charlottesville after Mr. Ferguson. And he said all the meetings were packed at this time. People were volunteering to do sit-ins and whatnot because they were trying to desegregate the schools and all the businesses and public places and bathrooms and whatnot in Charlottesville, because everything had white here and colored here. And he said, you know, they would go in and guns would be drawn on them, going in the wrong place, and they'd go up to lunch counter after lunch counter, and sometimes they wouldn't even bring any money because they weren't expecting to be served anything. And people would tell them, you know, we don't serve no niggas here and whatnot, and get on out and whatnot. And he said slowly but surely they had to give in, you know, to the fact that, you know, times were changing, and they started letting blacks, you know, sit at the lunch counters and come in the stores and whatnot. And he also said he felt it was mostly because Charlottesville didn't want to be behind little towns like Waynesboro and Lynchburg and whatnot, not on any real sincere effort to change, but just sort of a superficial cover to look good, you know, in the eyes of the public and whatnot, that Charlottesville wasn't so behind. And he made some real interesting comments about the University of Virginia's dealings during the whole period. He said a lot of white students participated in the sit-ins and the protests and whatnot with the blacks in Charlottesville, but he felt it was mostly done in fun and not out of any serious, sincere effort to help people. Although there were, you know, some, but most of the students just kind of wanted, you know, something to do. It just was the end thing to do, and they did participate in everything, though. He talked about some of the strategies they used for the sit-ins. One of them was that they were going to sit in someplace, but the police always sick dogs on them, you know, and threaten them and whatnot. So he and, you know, a couple other people went to the university professors, white professors, that were interested in, you know, helping out with the cause, and asked if their pregnant white wives would come along and march with them and sit in and protest. And they did. And in that way, they could ensure that the police wouldn't, you know, harm them or sick dogs on them, because they knew they wouldn't touch any white women that were married to professors and lawyers and whatnot in the university. Another technique he used during the whole 60s period was he couldn't quite remember, but some type of problem with someone's employment here at the university, some black person, and they wanted to protest it. And what he did was call up the university around graduation time and threaten to come down and protest and picket at the university's graduation, the May commencement exercises. And that got, you know, the administration and whatnot really upset and said, no, 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 you can't do that. You can't mess up our graduation. And he said, oh, yes, we can. And I'm going to get every bum on the street of Charlottesville I can find and every dirty, ratty-looking person and come down there and, you know, protest and raise Cain and whatnot. And so, of course, the university backed off and gave whoever was involved the employment and, you know, the demands that they wanted. But he would use tactics like this. And there was another tactic he used. He also said there were a lot of dedicated white people that were dedicated to the cause and stuck by them through the years, stuck by the NAACP and all the blacks that supported them at the time and are still sticking by them. He said one time there was a white woman, and he named her, and I can't remember her name, I think something happened to her. She was in the hospital or something. He said something about she wanted a black roommate. I can't remember if her husband was black or what, but no one in town was allowed to come near her because she had, you know, protested with, you know, with the blacks, and no whites were scared to help her out. She needed some place to stay one night. She had to go to Richmond. Whites were scared to help her out because they get in trouble. Blacks were scared to help her out because they certainly get in trouble. And he says he's been to jail many times and whatnot, and he's very outspoken, you know, in the community and what's going on, because, you know, he believes that if something has to be done, you're just going to have to get up and do it. Okay, he said that prior to that, blacks really had no role in city government or anything like that. He voted in the 40s, but in, you know, the city council meetings, but it didn't count for anything, because even if all blacks in Charlottesville had voted, it wouldn't have swung the vote one way or the other, because they're only like 10-12%, something like that. And that type of vote really doesn't change anything, and there's really no one on there, you know, or blacks anywhere on the city council and whatnot. And he talked about George Ferguson's daughter was the first little girl to go to Lane School, first little black child integrated. He talks about the integration efforts at that time. But he says he felt that blacks were the closest knit during this period. He said that Roy Wilkins would come down to Charlottesville and speak at the NAACP meetings and, you know, and tell people to keep on doing what they were doing and whatnot. That they had to keep on striving to make things better. Okay, he gave quite a few stories about just how rough it was for blacks in Charlottesville. He told one story about he was a little boy, about 4 or 5 years old, and he went to the store to get some candy. And the white man was in the store and told him, come on in here, little boy. You want some candy? Go on back behind the counter and get some candy. And he didn't know anything, and he went behind the counter to get the candy. And this white man came out the store and went and got this black woman that was passing along the street and took her out in back of the store and evidently raped her. But he didn't realize till years later that that's what had happened. And he said that happened, that type of thing happened systematically, and nobody ever said anything about it, because, you know, everybody was afraid to. And he talks about crosses burning on people's lawns and whatnot, and people being lynched. His father was lynched. I'm not quite sure whether he wanted this on the tape or not. I don't remember. But his father was lynched because he worked in dynamite, and some dynamite exploded and blew up some white man. And they accused him of knowing that the dynamite was going off and not telling the white man, and that he did it on purpose. And they went ahead and lynched him when he was about three. Mr. Brown was 3 months old at this time when that happened. He said there really wasn't a middle-class black community, but at that time they called it the 400 group of people, which were maybe, you know, the upper class of black people along the hill. But there really wasn't any strict lines separating one segment of the black community from another. He said he had no relatives living on the hill when he lived because everybody moves away, try and go somewhere and get a better job, all of his sisters and brothers. But he did grow up on Washington Street, but in the area, and had dealings in the area, since that was the place that black people went to enjoy themselves and for their recreation. He said that most of the homes were rented, and that black people didn't own that many homes in the area. This is a personal comment from my journal. as close knit as blacks were during in Charlottesville during the Civil Rights Movement and whatnot, the NAACP, well, it seems to me that urban renewal came along right after that, and nobody banded together to do anything. So what happened in between there? Yeah, that's true.
Because it was a bougie set from the jump.
Mm-hmm.
With the voice and all these people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, this man, Mr. Brown, said that, you know, he was so active in the community, you know, on the part of black folks, that he was pretty much ostracized and considered a troublemaker and whatnot. And he said that time was, you know, around the 30s and whatnot, that whenever a black person spoke back to a policeman or a judge, they were considered insane, mentally deranged, or could be locked up over in Western State. And they did that to people. Whenever, any time you ever talked back to anybody, any white person, you were considered, you know, crazy, out of your mind, and had to be locked up and put away. He said that happened many a time. And generally, I guess because of what his mother died when he was pretty young, in his arms, and his father was lynched, he always, he was kind of lost when he was growing up, but then after that he felt that he had to fight with his people, and he's still fighting to this day. And he's pretty much down on Charlottesville, but he's going to stay here, you know, and fight for it and trying to help young black people. He said that Charlottesville has come a long way, but it's still got a really long way to go. Okay, Mr. Brown also told a little anecdote about when he was about 11 years old, I think. He was working with some white woman, getting paid 50 cents more on a lawn. And he couldn't come in. He mowed on the weekend, and he couldn't come in on Monday. Oh, and he was trying to explain to the woman that he couldn't come in and finish cutting the grass for her lawn party on a Monday because he had to go to school. And his mother was trying to explain this to this white woman. And the woman told him, you know, well, you ought not to go to school. It makes you too, the more intelligent you people get, the more simple you get. And he said he always remembered that to this day. And that's how he remembers, you know, white people as treating black people in Charlottesville. He also told another story about a little boy who had a dog. And some white man rode up or rode by and, you know, came up to the house or something. And you know how dogs will always bark when somebody's coming up. And this dog started barking and he wouldn't shut up. This white man just out and out shot the dog because the man had been out hunting deer or something like that. But he shot him because, you know, he wasn't nothing but a little colored boy's dog and whatnot. And I think they took it to court. And the judge told him, you're going to have to... judge told the white man to get the little boy another dog. But he also told the little boy, don't let that dog, tie that dog up. And don't let him be barking at nobody no more.